Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Tom Hewitt. We also review A Delicate Balance. Peter talks with Diana Rigg. And Matt Tamanini from Broadway World joins us to talk about some television stuff. So please stay tuned.
Judge a book by its cover. I'm not much of a man by the light of day, but by night I'm one hell of a lover. I'm just a sweet transvestite. Transsexual Transylvania.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, January 11th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. It really is an honor to be with you.
Absolutely. Let me introduce everybody. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, with a new one, The Great Parade, to be released on April 7th, available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at filespotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Also with us, as we heard, is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's chief TV and film critic. He also writes across other Broadway World sites, including Broadway World Orlando, and serves as Broadway World's database manager. That's a lot of data there.
There's a lot.
He received a BA in journalism and communications from The Ohio State University and has worked in sports broadcasting, media relations, and journalism. He has also directed or produced 30 plays or musicals, currently writing two plays of his own. Good morning, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I really appreciate you guys having me on today.
With us this morning, a returning guest. We don't have very many returning guests, but Tom Hewitt is with us.
Gentlemen,
Tom,
hello.
Thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. It's nice to be back.
Well, you know, I was saying that. Tom was just on, but it was like almost, 18 months ago, up on 2 years ago, back when you were just doing the beginnings of another Medea, and now you have another production of it coming up. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, it's had quite a journey. This little play, I believe Michael saw it at the at the Duplex.
The Duplex.
We started doing readings of it at the Duplex. You know, it's basically 85 minutes of me sitting and in an interview, and my character's life parallels the Medea myth. And our writer-director, Aaron Mark, had directed Ben Rimmelauer's Patty Issues at the Duplex. So he had a relationship with those people and said, let's try it. You know, $10 a head, we'll do a reading and we'll see how it goes. And so there's like, candles on the table and people are delivering the second, gin and tonic while I'm talking about murdering my children. It was all very, very unusual context. But, we sort of saw that we had something, and James Nicola from the New York Theater Workshop came and saw it and invited us to spend a week at Dartmouth developing the piece with their summer residency there. Michael Walk from the All for One Festival saw it and invited us to perform it a few times last fall, October of 2013, at their All for One Festival. And he is now producing it again starting next week for a three-week run at the Wild Project on the Lower East Side. So, good for us. Reading at the Duplex and now getting a little off-Broadway run out of it. So,
So tell us a little bit, do you know much about All for One and Michael?
I don't know a whole lot. It's sort of a little bit of a new relationship. Do you guys know them? Has he been on the show?
No, he hasn't, but we've been getting press releases about All for One is doing a lot of stuff. Your stuff in there is just plugged full of, they're doing another thing called Devil in a Box. He's really focusing on one person shows and the development of those things, and that's really interesting. We have to see if we'll get Michael on to tell us more about that.
Yeah, he's a really interesting, smart guy, and he really champions the solo project. Now, another Medea is a little different in that it's a play. It's a complete fiction. You know, so many one-man shows have to do with a personal experience, and ours sort of isn't that. But Michael's such a champion of the one-person show. You know, it's artist-generated, as opposed to starting at the top with a producer or as a director and a casting. And blah, blah, blah. It's really, you know, the artist, it's from the ground up, and I think that's a really important thing to support, you know.
So you've been working on this for a little while. What's happened in between? Are you doing other stuff?
Yeah, off and on. I've been quote unquote underemployed for the past couple of years. It's been a little self-imposed. My partner is on tour, this big new tour of Phantom of the Opera. So I've been able to spend a lot of time with him and the dog out on the tour. So I'm really, really happy about that. But there's been some really fun things in between there too. Wonderful production of Irma Vep last summer with the great Bill Bowers, and you know, some stuff like that. And I've got some stuff to look forward to after Medea. So
It's funny because we never thought of you when we first started seeing you in Sisters Rosenzweig and in the School for Scandal. We assumed that you were this dramatic actor, this comic actor. We had no idea that you were going to turn out to be in so many musicals. So it's really quite nice to find out you had that extra talent, because I remember when they announced you for Chicago, I was a little surprised.
And I have to say, I never quite pictured you in a Rod Steiger role.
I know, right? When did that happen?
So tell us, we're dancing around it. Dr. Zhivago coming up in the spring. Are you getting ready for that?
Yes, I was lucky enough to be in a version of it in 2006 at the La Jolla Playhouse, directed by Des McAnuff. And it's been in development since then. I believe there have been productions in Korea and Australia. Mm-hmm. They've done some rewrites and some fixes, and it's coming in. We start rehearsals in February with a previews in March with an April opening.
Do you have many songs?
No, I don't have a huge amount of songs. It's a great role. It's a great, there's a lot of quality backstage time and fabulous costumes. I'm one of those characters is I'm kind of on the beginning of the end, and then people talk about me throughout the show. So it feels like I'm on stage longer than I actually am. So
I hope they say nice things about you while they're talking.
Well, they don't, but that's okay.
So you're getting ready for that, and so that will kind of, when that starts to happen in February, I guess everything in life gets put on hold until that all gets up and running, right?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, I live in Putnam County. I live about 60 miles north of the city of Putnam Lake, and you know, when these things happen, these technical rehearsals and previews, it's tough. It's really time-consuming. So I just got a cute little sublet. So I'm, going to be a little Manhattanite for the next few months. So that's great, too.
That's good.
You know, there's just no time. It's really, you know, you're there for 12 hours.
You can't live on Metro North.
You can't.
You know, I used to commute back and forth with Jeff McCarthy. I used to see him at Metro North nearly every night. And I was like, I forget what Jeff was in at the time, but certainly that, you know, you don't want to miss that 11:10 out of Grand Central, because it gets late after that.
Oh, indeed it does. Oh, my gosh, it's so true. It's so funny. The 11:10, can't miss it.
You can't miss it.
We're wishing that Dr. Zhivago has the success of two of the shows that you've been in, Chicago and The Lion King. It must be very nice to have been in two of the longest running shows in Broadway history. But I also want to know, of course, about the Rocky Horror Show, because if they were playing that iconic role of Frank N. Furter, given the fact that that was so famous a role from the movie, did you have many visitors, fans at the stage door waiting to meet Frank N. Furter?
You know, yes, as a matter of fact. Early on, we had an unusual challenge, too, because, of course, you know, people respond to the movie. There's it's interactive. Mm-hmm. And the pace of the play, the musical, and even the lines and scene arrangement is pretty different from the movie. So we had to sort of coach our audience into responding to our particular timing and show, because they responded to us too. They threw things and yelled things at us. And so it developed its own following its own thing that loved it for what it was. So there wasn't a lot of people that wanted, were expecting Tim Curry or expecting me to be a Frankenfurter in a particular way, which was really, really refreshing. I was embraced wholeheartedly by the Rocky community.
Well, there's no question that you asked for it because at the very beginning of the show, there they are saying, give me an R, R, give me an O, O. So that was essentially giving permission to everybody saying, look, we want your participation in this thing, which I thought was a very, very clever gambit. Yeah.
Very wise.
Well, it looked like you were having a blast. I hope you were. Yeah,
it was the funnest, most unusual job that I'll ever have. Now, I am a classic introvert. I'm a shy kid from a small town in Montana. Yeah, I don't have many friends. I'm uncomfortable at parties. I am a classic textbook shy guy. So, you know, this was definitely stepping out of my comfort zone. I had to, deal with different situations every night and was sort of thrust into a kind of social limelight. So all of that was really wonderful and challenging. You know, it really sort of broadened my horizons in a lot of ways. Now, I was lucky in that it worked best if I responded to the audience with the actual lines from the show. So that was sort of great too. But yeah, we had some crazy audience people. People my age would come and bring their children to the show, which I thought was an unusual thing. Let's take a nostalgic romp back to the good old days of, you know, drug abuse and transvestism, you know, when times were simpler.
I have to admit my son and I did the time warp together. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. It wasn't a pretty sight, but we did it.
Oh, what have we become?
Wait a minute. How does a boy from Montana get interested in theater? How does this happen?
Well, you know, it's a calling. It's a thing. It's a thing. You're going to do it. The entire universe was against me having an actor, against me being an actor, you know. And you just end up doing it because that's what you're going to do. It's what, you know. I was also really lucky because there aren't many actors in Montana. So I got to do a lot of things, like a wonderful touring Shakespeare company in the summer and this wonderful summer stock. I got to do a lot of things. I think in an urban setting, I would have been maybe, you know, a smaller fish in a bigger pond. So it was good for me. I'm really grateful for it. My parents were wonderfully supportive, and it all worked out good.
Yes, it has.
So you are, today is Sunday the 11th. You are beginning previews on Wednesday the 14th, and your official... And your official opening is Friday the 16th. So
that's
that two show previews on Spider-Man, you know. You know, you should sit down with the producers and say, you know, we could just run this like Spider-Man. We have, you know, 18 months of previews and then... But you can go to them and say, hey, you know, I've starred in two of the biggest successful shows on Broadway. Certainly you can bank on me, you know.
I know.
So if folks out there listening would like to go see another Medea. You say Medea, I say Medea.
Medea.
you can go to allforonetheater.org, and contact information is on our show page so that you can see the schedule and things like that. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining us again and telling us about it. And we're going to come harass you when Zhivago opens again.
Fantastic.
All right.
It's always a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll speak to you then.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Okay, see you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
He'll be pink, but quite clean. He'll be a strong man.
Strong man.
But the wrong man. He'll eat nutritious, high protein, and swallow raw eggs. Try to build up his shoulders, his chest, arms, and legs. Such an effort, if he only knew of my plan. When in just 7 days, I can make you a man.
So Michael got a chance to see A Delicate Balance, which we did not review back in November, so when it came out. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Oh, yes. We didn't review it because basically some of us didn't get press invites until considerably after the opening, because I believe the show was considered a very big hit. It was, the advance sales were incredible, and it was really packed. And that's not surprising when you hear the cast. Glenn Close, John Lithgow, Lindsay Duncan, Bob Balaban, Claire Higgins, and Martha Plimpton, directed by Pam McKinnon, I should say, the wonderful Pam McKinnon. Glenn Close is, you know, I was just talking about this with a friend the other day. I guess she is really the kind of person that people will really put down the big bucks for. She does not come to Broadway that often anymore. In fact, she never really did. She would do something really big, and then months, years would go by, and then she'd come back. And I'm sure we all remember the story about how the box office plummeted when she went on vacation, or was it when she left entirely, for Sunset Boulevard. And there were, does anyone remember this? There was accusations that the figures were being cooked.
Yeah.
To make it look as if it had not dropped off so badly. Mm. And then she, I think, got involved in that and made a statement, you know, basically against Lloyd Webber and the producers. it was fun times. But anyway, she really does seem to be what we consider a really big star when she comes to Broadway, and it creates a lot of excitement. I thought this was a very solid production overall. The last one that I had seen was so perfect that I, you know, I don't know if I could ever see anything better than that one, any interpretation better than that one. It was just about perfection. Let me just, I had it up here and then I lost it. It was 1996, and it was George Grizzard, Rosemary Harris, Elaine Stritch, Mary Beth Hurt, John Carter, and Elizabeth Wilson. So I'm feel privileged to see two such excellent productions of this play in my lifetime, and not that far apart, really. It's a play, for those who don't know it, it's a very existential play about a apparently extremely wealthy couple who have, their main issues are that their daughter has been married multiple times, and she is just ending her latest marriage, and she's coming home to stay, basically having nowhere else to go. And she wants to move back into, as she calls it, my room, even though, you know, it's theoretically not anymore. But she can't, because the closest friends of this couple have come, just showed up completely unexpectedly one night with, well, they don't have their bags yet. They're going to go back and get them. But it's clear that they want to move in. And when they're asked what is wrong, all they can say is that they were frightened. So it's all about existential fear and fear of the unknown, and who your friends are, and how much you will put yourself out for a friend, and where limits are. And it's really a very, very, I think it's one of Albee's better plays of the period, although at the time it was not extremely well received because of where it fell in his canon. And I think he was, in a sense, beginning to fall out of fashion, although he certainly came back into fashion later. I thought the cast was very good for the most part. Martha Plimpton, as the daughter Julia, she had a very affected style of speech that distracted me on several occasions. I mean, it was obviously a choice. I've never heard her speak that way before. And these people are supposed to be quite rich, very upper class. So it's not inappropriate in that sense. But I felt she was the only one who was doing it. So that distracted me a little from her otherwise very good performance. Glenn Close did seem a little surfacey in the role of Agnes, although it's one of those cases where I'm not sure that's a criticism, because she is supposed to be – the woman's supposed to be extremely self-possessed. She's the one who's like kind of trying to hold everything together and just move from one thing to the next, and when horrible things boil up, she tries to tamp them down. So so that is very much the character to some degree. I guess maybe I didn't see quite enough going on beneath the surface, at least not in the first few scenes. Later on, maybe some of that came out, so that was good. Lithgow, I thought, was entirely excellent. Interestingly, there are two British women in leads in the show, Lindsay Duncan and Claire Higgins, both of whom I would say do almost flawless American accents. There again, only occasionally do they say something that reminds you that they're not American. And that takes you out of it a little bit, but not to to distract from really excellent work. And Bob Balaban, I thought was superb in this, what I would say is the smallest role in the whole thing. Harry, the male half of the couple who comes to visit. So I think that they did an excellent job with the show. The set by Santo Laquasta was quite something, and the costumes, Ann Roth, and very well produced, as you might imagine. And it is a play that I think deserves to be seen regularly. And God knows the roles are so meaty that I'm sure there will never be a lack of actors willing to take them on. Even big stars, like Glenn Close and John Lithgow.
So, Peter, you were going to see it, but you didn't see it, right?
Right. They told me Glenn Close was out. Michael, do you know anything about that?
Well, I heard because someone else told me they were notified ahead of time, which is always nice, that she was out for a personal reason. I of course, I have no idea what that means. But I went the next night expecting to see her, of course. And it was just before the show, and we're filing in, and some gentleman like three seats down from me says, "Is Glenn Close out of the show tonight?" I said, I hope not. I don't think so. I know she was out last night. And the fellow showed me he had the insert in his program, in his playbill, saying that she was out. And I said, you know, I think they just let that one slip. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, the curtain goes up on Glenn Close sitting there. So we knew that that she was in it. And there wasn't a mistake.
By the way, I don't know if this is still true, but there was a time when ushers used to get paid a certain amount of money to put those slips in the playbill. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, I once saw an exam that theater managers had to take in which they said, if there are three people out and the ushers have three pieces of paper to put in, how much extra does that, you know? So it was really like like one of those math questions you used to get as a kid, you know, if Susie has four quarts of, you know, and blah, 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 you know. So so I found that pretty fascinating that they got paid by the piece of paper, overtime type stuff. But I don't know if that's still true.
Oh, I don't know either. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the ushers still do it. I don't know if what they get paid for it, but mm-hmm. I think that they do it, don't they?
I would think so. I imagine it hasn't
changed. That you'd have to pay them at the end of the night to remove these slips from the program so that doesn't happen with Michael's case.
You're right, right. How funny. But you know what that indicates, too? That indicates that all the playbills were not used that night, which isn't surprising. You know, that a lot of people must have gone to the box office and, excuse me, I ain't coming tonight. I'm coming another time.
And obviously that should be, I mean, mistakes happen. And when you think of how many hundreds of those they had to do.
Of course,
but that's not a good thing to let one of those slip, because you're going to, like give somebody a heart attack.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, I guess they could just, you know, do what they did, ask someone else or ask the usher. But it's better if it's.
And those slips are a collector's item, I'm sure.
At least for the understudy.
I remember back in the days of Sunset Boulevard, when Glenn Close finally left the show and Elaine Page came in, and the box office dramatically dropped. There was such a brouhaha over it, beyond what Michael was saying, where I think that when Glenn went on vacation, that there was the discussion that Andrew Lloyd Webber was actually buying seats to keep the numbers up.
Now that you remind me, I remember there was something like that. I knew there was some chicanery supposedly going on to inflate the box office and make it not look like there had been a big drop.
And then I don't know if you remember that everybody, Glenn bought fake nose and glasses for everybody in the cast so that when they were leaving the stage door, that they could, everybody could be undercover. It was, Glenn was very, very fun. I happened to be, know some folks in that company, and I spent Tony Awards with them. And, and Glenn brought, at the time, showing our age here, disposable cameras with film in them. Kids,
imagine.
There was a time when there was this plastic substance
that's
inside
right,
a camera.
Right. And we were glad to have it.
And at the Tony Awards party, Glenn took had these disposable cameras and took pictures of her with a person with the Tony Award and gave them the camera.
Ah, nice.
So that they can take it home and get it developed and blown up and things, everything like that. And she had a few parties, barbecues and things like that, up in her house at Greenwich, Connecticut, with the company as well. So she was wonderful in the cast back in Sunset Boulevard.
My only question is, did this really happen when Elaine Page came in, or was it when Betty Buckley came in? Because she succeeded Glenn Close.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I know that when Elaine came in, that
I think first
that basically closed the show because
no, I know, and I thought she was terrific in it, by the
yeah.
way.
Yeah,
right. But I think if I recall, there was a before she left entirely. Before
yeah, she went vacation.
Yeah, and that was when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, so let's move forward. Peter, you had an interview with Diana Rigg, and tell us about what she's up to these days.
Well, it was a great bit of fun to go up to the Thalia Theater on 95th Street and Broadway and meet Diana Rigg. And, of course, I had a million questions to ask her dealing with her career, be it the Avengers, be it as Mrs. James Bond. She's the only woman to have landed James Bond, and that was in her on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and talking about Colette as well, a musical she did that closed out of town, in which it was amazing to me how much responsibility she took for that, saying that they shouldn't have hired me. I don't have a good enough voice. but I have a feeling she did have a good enough voice because she certainly sounds good on the Follies original cast album in London. What was funny was that I asked her about the new songs that came in. She said, well, you know, this song Country House, which was so difficult, and Stephen Sondheim only got it to me about a couple of weeks before we actually started previews. And I thought, yeah, she doesn't know that Sondheim was notoriously late when writing songs. He just, to the last minute. And, of course, considering the songs are so good, it's not surprising that it would take till the last minute for these songs to be done. I asked her a question that I wish she had an answer to, because it's such the question is better than the concept, because I asked her about Ah But Underneath, the song that replaced Lucy and Jesse in the London Follies. And it's a striptease, and there's puns with the words like appeal, and the point is that she would take something off when saying Peel. And I said, do you think Sondheim got the idea for the song? Because you were playing Emma Peel in the Avengers. It wouldn't it be great if the answer were, oh, yes, that's exactly where it came from. But she didn't know and didn't think that that was it. And I don't think it's it either. But it would have been great fun if it had been that indeed. It would have been quite wonderful. So, but, you know, we got off to a very shaky start because she came in. She wanted to tell me the story about when she was in A Midsummer Night's Dream, that they were taping it for BBC television, and it was a very windy day, and her dress was going up, and Peter Hall, the director, said to her, Diana, the problem is you're wearing contemporary knickers. Knickers, of course, being the British word for panties. He said, you're going to have to take them off. She said, and I did. And I said, well, I hope nobody else has ever said that to you. And she said, do you mean that you don't think I should ever have sex? You know, and whoa, you know. And there I go, well, no, that's not what I mean. No,
Not in a professional context.
Right. Yeah. I wish I had those words at that moment, but I thought, oh God, the first moment already I'm blowing them. You know, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression, as that famous expression goes. Yeah. You know, and here I was, you know, and she was playing with me. She was having a good time. And it was, of course, her way of saying, relax, you know, it's going to be all right. We're going to have a good time out there. And we did have a good time out there. It really was quite nice. I ended the discussion by asking her a question that was asked of Colette in this musical that closed. The question was, somebody asked Colette, some character asked Colette, if you could live your life over, what would you keep and what would you throw away? And without any provocation, she said, I'd keep it all, just as Colette did on stage. Diana Rigg gave the exact same line, and I'm wondering, of course, if she remembered the line or if she was just giving me her opinion at that moment in time. Hmm. It could very well have been. So, but what was also interesting was that the first, I'd say, five or six rows were packed with late middle-aged men who went to bed every night dreaming of Emma Peel. You know, and I'm telling you, when the time came for questions, they were asked about episode 6, you know, season 2, you know, that type of thing. And the smiles on their faces that I could see, you know, and that they couldn't believe they were in the same room with their beloved Emma Peel. But of course, that character was also important to women, you know, because this was an empowerment situation for a lot of women. Emma Peel, by the way, was not supposed to be a woman in the first place. They talked about getting a man. It would be like a buddy comedy. Finally, they said, well, let's get somebody who has male appeal. And then on memos, they started abbreviating that to M appeal. And that's where the name came from, M appeal, because of M appeal. And again, did Sondheim know that story? And again, did that come into the writing of But Underneath? You know, I guess we'll never know. But it was quite a nice event, and I'm glad to say there was a full house there with people waiting to get in just on the off chance. She does have her fans, and she deserves them.
Do you have to address her as Dame?
You know, I didn't quite ask her that. I just routinely did it, and I got the impression from a look she gave me as if to say, that isn't necessary, and after that, I didn't. I did find out when I wrote about this for my Crystalline column, I called her Dame Rigg, thinking that was the way to show great respect, but I'm told you actually do the name. In fact, one of my readers wrote and said, didn't you learn anything from Dame Edna? You know,
that's one of the many things she taught us.
Yes, indeed. I mean, but I don't know if you can go by Dame Edna for being, you know, a representative of great royalty. You know, I mean, Dame Edna might very well. I mean, it might very well be a sense that you should call her Dame Everidge, but indeed, because she's just down home folks that, and she wants to canoodle with us in the best sense of the word, that she allows us to call her Dame Edna. So I don't think I would have inferred that from that. But anyway, for the rest of you, whenever you meet a dame, use the first name and not the last name.
Now I have two questions. Did you go there or was it discussed beforehand about love letters?
I did not bring up love letters at all. If she were to bring it up, I was going to say, is there any love lost between you and the producers of Love Letters? You know, but it didn't come. However, I will say that Nell Nugent, the lead producer of Love Letters, did show up to see her and afterwards came backstage and said, I feel terrible about all this and all that. And Dame Diana said, oh, please don't worry about it. No problem. You know, so she was very, so I do know that much. And you had another question you said?
Yeah, also, I don't think you mentioned this, but did the film of A Little Night Music come up?
Only in the sense that she mentioned that that's how Sondheim was interested in her for Follies.
Oh.
I thought it best not to bring up Night Music, frankly. You know, because
it's interesting.
She's very good in it. She is. There's no problem with her. And wouldn't it have been wonderful if she, it would have been wonderful, if she had played Desiree.
Well, as I recall, she got across the board raves for her
book, yeah,
and was the only one, as I recall. Yeah. Not one other person. Well, you know, and I mean, they were so done in by the just the whole
yes.
Johnson, the cheats of the filming and the you know. Blah, blah. Yes.
How did we get from Diana Rigg to Dame Edna? Only here. All right, so let's move on. Matt, in, as your role as the chief television and film critic at Broadway World, you are forced to watch these television shows, aren't you?
some of them I'm forced, some of them I do it willingly, but it depends on the day and the episode.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Michael, Peter, and I have seen our share of pretty bad things live, and hopefully.
So why should you be exempt? Right?
Yes, exactly. So Matt,
share the wealth. Yeah.
I guess it was last week we started a new show called Gallivant.
Gallivant. Yep.
And why don't you tell us about that?
Well, Gallivant is they're billing it as a comedy extravaganza, but really what it is it's a musical half an hour show that they've pieced together two episodes on each Sunday night for the four Sundays in January. Oh. The music is by Alan Menken, which is really kind of what they're hanging their hat on in terms of all the marketing, because there aren't a whole lot of stars in the show itself. The lyrics are by Glenn Slater. So definitely two people that have quite a rich theatrical history. But it's a show that's set in the medieval times, but it's a comedy with a very modern sensibility. There are some fairly meta winking jokes going on, and they kind of build it as part Monty Python and Spamalot and part Princess Bride. I'm not exactly sure if it hits those marks all that well at times, but you know, I wasn't sure that it was going to find an audience. Like I said, when the biggest star associated with your program is the composer, generally those things don't do well in terms of musicals. I mean, that's why you see every movie musical you see is packed with huge stars to get people who aren't necessarily accustomed to musicals to go and see it. So I was a little skeptical. But last Sunday's two episodes, which they shot them as two episodes, their build is two episodes, but it's really 1 hour of television, did incredibly good ratings. It did a 9.4 million people, which when you combine that, that's actually bigger than Peter Pan Live did back in December. So much so that ABC even reran that initial hour later in the week at a later time slot, and it did another 3 million. So I was shocked that there was that much of an audience for it. Now, will they stay and come back tonight for another hour? I'm not sure, but it was a surprisingly nice little bonus surprise in the news for musical theater fans this week.
Yeah.
So Alan Menken, am I remembering correctly, he had another show on ABC 2 years ago or so, some weird alien show?
He it wasn't his show. It was called Neighbors, and he did a musical episode of that.
Yeah.
And so I think he's in a quest to get the E for his EGOT, and I'm not sure if this will do it, but he's definitely pulling all the right strings to make it happen.
Speaking of Gallivant, you're probably way too young to have even heard of this, but there was a show years ago. Have we mentioned this recently? Called When Things Were Rotten. It was a Mel Brooks TV show, and it was about I barely remember it, but it was about Robin Hood, wasn't it, Peter?
Yeah, and it had a wonderful theme song by Strauss and Adams. Terrific. The only gag I remember is when somebody else, because it took place in the same era, you know, hold your tongues, and everybody stuck out his tongue and held it with his fingers. That type of thing. That's the only joke I remember from it. And it seems whenever I talk about the show, that's the only joke anybody remembers from it. But even with Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks was very hot then, because this is the 70s we're talking about, and you know, this is the era of High Anxiety and Blazing Saddles, and needless to say, the producers were still fondly remembered. So as a result, we did expect big things from When Things Were Rotten, and it didn't happen. So we'll see what happens with Gallivant.
Do you remember, other than the title song, were there musical numbers in it?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so at all. I think it was just the theme song. But it had that wonderful Charles Strauss bounce. He's really good at that.
And this is just from my memory. I didn't look it up. Wasn't Dick Gauthier in it?
Yes, indeed. The original.
Gautier, yeah.
The original Conrad Birdie, indeed. Yep. So, but now, Matt, are you encouraged by the fact that people are watching a show that is a musical and it's that, as you say, you were surprised. And the fact I'm surprised here that it did better than Peter Pan Live. So, was the advanced publicity on the show really intense too?
Well, it was. It was something that throughout all of the holidays, it was pushed pretty hard. You heard that same thing song over and over and over again. Uh-huh. And it was something that seems to have caught on. Now, what I thought was interesting about it was, is that a lot of the marketing, if you've seen the commercials or even the stuff online, it seems like a very family friendly hour. It's on at 8 p.m., which is generally on a Sunday night considered a family friendly hour. But there's a bit of naughty humor. When you compare yourself to Monty Python, there's some things that might not be copacetic for the younger audiences, so much so that they've actually got to bleep out some profanity at times. So I was surprised. I mean, obviously, when you think about some of Alan Menken's work with Disney, there's always some of those jokes for adults, depending on what lyricist he's working with. But this is even more adult than that. There are some pretty overt sexual references that I think probably go over the heads of most kids. But I was surprised by that in terms of the marketing being so family friendly. But, you know, I think with the success of things like Into the Woods right now and the even Peter Pan Live, even though it didn't necessarily draw anywhere near what Sound of Music did, it still was one of the highest rated things NBC's had on a Thursday night other than sports in years. So there's still an audience for it. Is it something that an audience that will come back for a serialized show for four or five seasons? We saw what happened with Smash and Glee, you know, not doing all that well in terms of ratings. So I'm not sure, but for a 4-week, as they call it, comedy extravaganza, this might be something that they can do every once in a while to kind of combat what NBC is doing with the live productions.
All right, but the question becomes, we have heard that the original plans were that Music Man was going to be the next broadcast, and now I'm hearing that those same producers are doing a movie of Pippin. Do you feel that that means that we're not going to see Music Man next year, that they're going to concentrate their energy on the movie of Pippin?
Well, they have Neil Marin and Craig Zidane have said recently that that is their next feature film product with the Weinsteins is going to be Pippin. They haven't said when that's going to be. And to be honest with you, they weren't ever officially tied to the Music Man production.
I see.
NBC had optioned Music Man. They've also optioned A Few Good Men for a live production. They haven't said if that's going to be this year. I think A Few Good Men has gotten a little more for a production this year, not in that holiday slot that we've seen from Sound of Music and Peter Pan. But Music Man is something they've got. I'm not sure if that's going to be what they do in December or if they do it at all. I mean, I think the letdown of the numbers from Peter Pan might discourage them, but I think that was more to do with the casting and maybe the picking of the show. I think depending on who they would cast in Music Man, it could do just as well as Sound of Music. But I think Craig and Neil have proven that with everything they do in feature films, everything they do on TV, and with producing the Oscars, they can split their time. So if they wanted to do both Music Man and Pippin, I think those two guys can figure out how to make their schedules work.
So you didn't mention any of the actors' names in Gallivant.
Gallivant is played by Joshua Sassy, who's a British actor, and his the story of it is that he's this big famous knight who is world renowned, and he's in love with this beautiful woman named Madalena, and the evil king comes and kidnaps her and forces her to marry him. As he rushes off to go prevent her from marrying him, Madalena, who's played by Mallory Janson, says, you know what? I love you, but you're poor. The king is rich. I'm going to stay with him. And so he kind of goes into a downward spiral where he packs on a few pounds around the midsection and becomes a little depressed until another princess comes and asks him to save her kingdom. And that's played by Karen David. She plays Princess Isabella. And the cast is great. The only actors that I really knew from the cast, because most of them are British, is the king is played by Timothy Odmundson, who is of Psych, if you've ever seen that show on USA. Mm-hmm. Which had a nice musical episode a couple years ago. He plays the king. And then Vinnie Jones plays kind of his bouncer henchman, who Vinnie Jones is a former British football player, a soccer player, and he's been in a bunch of movies. I think he was in maybe one of the Fast and Furious movies or something. Or Gone in 60 Seconds, I think is what it was. So there's not a whole lot of the main cast that's familiar. However, the guest stars are where a lot of the stars are. In the first hour, we had John Stamos. We've got Hugh Bonneville from Downton Abbey coming up. You've got Weird Al Yankovic, of all people. Ricky Gervais, Anthony Stewart Head, and Faith Prince is actually going to be in it later in the season as well.
Oh.
All right. So let's talk about what's happening on Glee. It's the final season. Kicked off the other night. Can you give us a couple of minutes on Glee?
Yeah, well, because I knew I was going to be talking to you guys, I sucked it up and watched the first 2 hours of Glee just for you. Apparently, I was one of the few people that did. The ratings were frankly terrible for Glee, but that's kind of not a surprise considering they moved it to a Friday night airing. Glee is back for its final season. It's only going to be 13 episodes. Basically, everybody who they decided to move to New York has come back home to Lima, Ohio, which kind of repositions the show, trying to get it back to its roots. Rachel, played by Lea Michele, of course, has taken over the McKinley Glee Club, and it's right. And it's only been about 6 months since the last season ended, when she was starring as Fanny Bryce on Broadway. So it's Glee. It strains credulity a little bit, but it's Glee. If you're prone to like it, you probably will. I have to admit, there were some things that made me smile last night, but it's still a show that in my mind suffers from not having a great strong hand by the executive producers. It's a show that from episode to episode can take on a wildly different tone and feel in writing. And I think that's hurt it. I think the tone from that first season, where it was winning Golden Globes, was something that really drew people, that little edginess that made it okay to have high school kids singing down the hallways, because it had that kind of satiric tone to it. And then it lost that here and there. And so it only drew about 2.3 million people, down 65% from last year's premiere. So it's probably smart to burn these off on a Friday. But, you know, if you're prone to liking Glee, you'll probably enjoy the last season. I'm sure they'll pull out all the stops in terms of previous stars coming back. And so I'm sure it'll be entertaining. But I do want you to know that I did spend part of my Saturday watching it just for you guys.
Funny, you're a Christian martyr. the question becomes, you are telling me that they are now indicating that the kids who went to New York did not succeed there and came back home?
It depends on the kid. What Lea Michele's character Rachel did is she left Funny Girl to go do a sitcom. It was the lowest rated episode of all time, so she goes home. Then Blaine, played by Darren Criss, and his boyfriend break up, so he moves back home because he's depressed. And then Kurt Colfer, who plays Blaine's boyfriend, Kurt, gets for his third year of college, they have to do a professional internship, which he decides to do back home in Lima. So everybody kind of works their way back in some way or another.
So is the message of the show that if you try to find your dreams, you're not going to achieve them?
Well, you know, that's funny, because that's actually something that's hit on pretty well in that first episode. You know, kind of the tongue-in-cheek thing that Jane Lynch's character always does is kind of bring out the worst side of everything, and then the rest of the Glee cast tries to sing about it and make it all better. So I think it's probably going to be more of a sense of you can go home again is what the season will probably focus on, more than if you have a dream and you don't succeed at first, you're never going to achieve it. I don't think that's going to be the message they leave us with.
Uh-huh.
Funny story. I have very few VHS tapes left in my apartment, and I had one yesterday that I noticed that was not labeled, and I said, "Well, let me see what's on this."
You're not supposed to watch the one that's not labeled.
Just in case. Well, exactly.
Why it's not labeled, right?
Yeah, you find a VHS tape in your mom and dad's bedroom, and it's not labeled. Please destroy it.
I live alone, so that wasn't going to be a problem. But I put it in, and what was it but Matthew Morrison and Lea Michele singing "Endless Love."
Oh. You see, you should have destroyed it.
I assume from the first season.
Yeah, well, and if you're gonna watch Glee, watch the first season. I mean, it was a show that was new, it was fresh, it had a tone and a sensibility that was completely different from anything else on TV. Putting aside the musical element, but since then, the nature of episodic television, especially hour long dramas on networks, is that you've always got three or more episodes in production. So you've got different writers and directors working on episodes at the same time. And so because Ryan Murphy does so many different things, and I think this is a criticism that's true of American Horror Story as well, you don't get the cohesiveness of an entire season or even of an entire show. It just kind of bounces back and forth. It's a little all over the map. So I think that's what really did Glee in the long run. It wasn't the singing. It wasn't the cast. It was, not the strong hand of a visionary producer.
But that's funny you say that, Matt, because my impression is that TV viewers are not bothered by that, but they actually like it. I mean, I watch things that are within an episode, they vary wildly in tone and things, and these things are very successful. It just seems like just do something outrageous is the watchword now.
Sure.
But that's interesting to me that you say so. Maybe the critics still don't like it, but
I think the issue is that Glee always would go from something that was very sardonic in one episode to something that's very sweet in another one. You saw a lot of stuff early on about Sue Sylvester's sister, who I believe had Down syndrome. And I think those kind of tonal right. shifts are fine. It's when those shifts are so monstrous that you don't really even know who the character is from week to week that it becomes an issue. Things like you might have been mentioning things like Scandal on ABC, which jumps so wildly from week to week in terms of its plot, still keeps the core of each character as to who they are. Now, those events might change who the character is from week to week, but you see the impetus for that change. On Glee, it just seems to be like, it's a new week. This person's now a monster and we don't like her anymore, as opposed to last week when she was the sweet character. I think those are the shifts that I'm talking about, not right. necessarily the big surprising, extravagant changes that I think you might have been mentioning.
Well, I guess I was talking about both, but it's funny. It's funny how things dovetail. We got an email that James just sent around from someone questioning. Actually, it was in regard to The Last Ship, but how far should one be willing to suspend disbelief, especially in highly stylized things like musicals? That are not necessarily presented as ultra realistic to begin with, but is there still a standard? I'll never forget. For me, I really gave up on Glee right. I think it was the first episode, or maybe the second or third, when Matthew Morrison finds out that his wife is supposedly pregnant, so he quits his job as a teacher because he thinks he needs to find something with quote unquote better benefits. And he quits his job without having a better one. And we actually see him sitting in an employment office filling out an employment form. And I thought, I'm sorry, I can't. I just can't,
So as Michael mentioned, Jeff Daugherty, one of our listeners, wrote in and asked, and it works in really well with what you're saying at about students running down the hallway singing. And he said, as I'm an English teacher, I was wondering what you, Peter, and Michael consider the tipping point where the willing suspension of disbelief no longer applies in a musical and the plot becomes untenable or absurd. Aren't musicals inherently suspensions of disbelief since most people do not sing through their daily lives? Well, I actually do sing through my daily life, but others might not. So,
Peter, I have a short answer to the
Michael?
Question.
Yeah, okay.
Go ahead.
I think if you buy into the whole of what you're watching, that you are much more likely to be forgiving of the of whatever inconsistencies and wildly incredible things may happen. But if you don't, then you're going to be the first one to say, oh, that's ridiculous. And because I know I myself, from one thing to the next, I don't think there's a specific line where I say, oh, you know, that's ridiculous. It really depends on the overall piece and how you're reacting to it.
My feeling is involves high school algebra, if you remember that at all, and I hope you don't in many instances. But there was something called a given in those problems that we were given, and I think it's a given that people sing and dance in musicals, and that's part of the concept. After that given, whatever happens has to conform to some sort of belief system, that we do have to buy what's going on. Yes. The type of thing that I throw up my hands at, for example, I've said this many times, and I know people who love Man of La Mancha hate when I bring this up, but by the time Don Quixote says, no, that is not a barber's bowl, that is a golden helmet, that's where I tune out. I can't do it anymore, because even though I am an optimistic person, I want to believe the character, and I can't believe him anymore that he's being optimistic. I think he's crazy. I think he's senile. I think he's demented. So my suspension of disbelief goes right at that point. So we all have our thresholds of pain, and we all have our thresholds of disbelief. And while other people say, oh, isn't it wonderful that he thinks that that's a golden helmet, I can't. So different strokes of different folks here, and but I do believe that when you are watching a musical, you have to give the fact that there's going to be singing and dancing, and that does not give license that
right.
everything else can be absurd. I want the framework, the rest of it, to be make sense and make me believe.
Yes, I agree.
Huh. So with this comes the information this week that The Last Ship is closing, which we sort of expected. So what do you think? I mean, Sting brought in quite some large numbers there while he was in it. And then it turns out that the producers are thinking, I guess, that without Sting in it, that it's not going to fly.
Well, for that matter, I think that they expected more business than they got. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as if they sold out and suddenly it was a hot ticket. Mm-hmm. So there's no sense throwing good money after bad. You know, I think one of the smartest things that ever happened in the history of Broadway musicals was when the Merrily We Roll Along producers said, we're quitting after 2 weeks. You know,
yeah.
Fighting is right. is just such an uphill battle, and people get tired of you hanging around. I swear, Merrily We Roll Along wouldn't have all these productions if it had run 193 performances and closed at a total loss. There's something about knowing when to leave. And what will happen now, because the show closed rather quickly, is there are certainly community theater directors out there who really believe they can solve the problems of The Last Ship, whatever they may be, and will do it. While if indeed it hung around forever and ever and ever, then it becomes this boring show that was a failure, as opposed to an intriguing show that was a failure. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised. Besides, it's a Kevin McCollum show, is it? Am I right? Am I wrong?
The Last Ship?
I
think it's the other guy, isn't it?
Jeff Seller.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was going to say that
Jeffrey Seller. Yeah.
Okay. That if it were Kevin McCollum, that indeed he has something rotten coming up, and that's pretty exciting. So I would think that you'd want to move on to that. But yes, it was, as we say, the other guy, as they say in Bells Are Ringing.
So
I was just thinking that as we were just talking, while I think The Last Ship is an example of being asked to suspend disbelief to a degree that I'm not able to provide. I also don't think that's what hurt the show at all. I think it's just maybe a combination of the subject matter and the marketing. that for whatever reason, people did not think they wanted to see that. Although it would have been interesting, needless to say, to see how much, if any, different the reception would have been had Sting been in it from the beginning. Because, you know, going into it later is not the same thing.
It's
obviously.
Not at all.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that is one of the great answered, one of the great unanswered questions of this season, at least anyway, I would say.
So, I don't know.
Let's not forget this too. This is a show that didn't have much, you should pardon the expression at the risk of being sexist, female appeal. It just didn't. This was not the show that, the women who certainly go to the theater may very well have been drawn to. It's a very testosterone-y type show, and I don't see Wednesday matinees doing well with it, if indeed there are still women who go to Wednesday matinees. I may be all wrong about this, but I do think that shows that have inherent female appeal tend to do better than shows that don't.
I don't think you're wrong about that, but on the other hand, they might have played up the love story.
Sure.
You know, that whole thing about their relationship, and that I don't even remember now exactly when it's quote unquote revealed that the boy is the son. But that's something that might have been played up in the marketing, you know, rather than the market. I mean, I like that logo, but it doesn't really tell you anything.
No,
you know.
It's a pretty image. Yes, yeah. I agree with that.
So if folks listen to last week's broadcast, Peter said towards the very end of it, he says, by the next time that we record our next show, we better hear something about The Visit or it's not happening. So I'm sure that Tom Curtis, he took that to heart and jumped
That's
on
it.
The press release and said, hey, Peter, The Visit is coming in, and it's coming in fast.
Now, here's the question. I mean, granted, the Lyceum is a Schubert Theater, and of course, the Richard Rogers Theater is a Niederlander Theater, but has it occurred to anybody that the Lyceum is a rather small theater? And again, The Visit is not that large a musical. I'll grant you, I saw it in Virginia. Still, if then suddenly announcing a closing, will there be any possibility that The Visit might visit the Richard Rogers Theater as opposed to the Lyceum? I must say, across my mind, I think it's highly unlikely for the reasons I brought up, you know, different managements and all that. I know that a lot of theaters want to be, a lot of shows want to be in bigger theaters than smaller.
And here is another question that a friend of mine brought up, and it's, you know, it's, he's absolutely right. Why didn't the Roundabout do it? They have that theater's going to be open now. They owe another show to their subscribers. They have a history with Candor and Cheetah Rivera. I wonder if it was at least discussed. It must have been, right? Don't you think?
Yeah, I would, sure.
And maybe it didn't pan out because they weren't sure if Cabaret was closing, or they didn't have weren't sure if they had the funds. I don't know.
You're applying logic to an illogical business. So something else that we had talked about over a number of episodes is, are Christian Borle and Brian D'Arcy James going to be in something rotten? Well, yes, they are.
Yes, they are. I hope they get the rest of them, too. John Cariani, Brad Oscar, Kate Reinders, Beth Level. It's a small part, I'll grant you, but I hope they get the rest of them, too. But at least the fact that they have Brian D'Arcy James and Christian Borle, who are so sensational in those roles, is certainly a tremendously wonderful thing.
All right, so let's wrap up for today, and please stay tuned for Peter's trivia challenge. But before we do that, I'm going to let you know that Broadway Radio can be subscribed to in iTunes by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. And if you click on the link, you can subscribe to us. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device. That way, it'll stream directly to you. And as Matt well knows, Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and we very much appreciate that. Contact information for Peter, Michael, Matt, and I can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So, Petey, what do you have for us in Trivia Challenge?
All right. I want you to identify this person. He appeared in two movie versions of 50s Broadway musicals. His appearance in the first necessitated a retooling and a retitling. In the second, he had a mere uncredited cameo. In the 60s, he appeared in a film version of a 50s hit that had run close to a year, although his participation in the film automatically vulgarized the character that had been in the play. That he was starring in a big musical in the 70s almost caused a piece of New York real estate to be named for him until the show closed in Boston. Broadway didn't hear from him again until the 90s, although it may yet hear from him again.
I know.
Who is he?
But I can't tell you.
Yeah, that's all right. Okay. Good, good. So that's my trivia question.
Not qualified for the...
right.
Do the disclaimer.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, your mileage may vary. All righty. So next week, Peter is off to Atlanta. You're off to Hotlanta for the conference?
The Junior Theater Festival, which is marvelous. If you're a teacher out there who has middle school kids, please find out about this festival. Kids come from all around the country, and I even mean Wyoming, and they perform 15-minute excerpts from these musicals they've either done or will be doing. And it's a wonderful event. It's nice to be with 4,000, and I mean that, kids who care about musical theater, who dance in the aisles, and just have a wonderful time meeting and making friends, and performing for pros who give them feedback on what they did right and what they did wrong. And such a great weekend. So I really look forward to it. And do investigate it, teachers, really. You owe it to your kids.
So Peter won't be with us next week. Matt, can you join us once again next week?
Sure, I'd love to.
Absolutely. We'll talk a little bit more about television and also talk about some tours that are coming through the Orlando area that you saw at the Dr. Phillips. You saw Phantom down there, didn't you?
I did. I saw the new revised tour.
Great. So we'll talk about that next week. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, Matt Tamanini, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Just 7 days, I can make you a man. I don't want no dissension. Just dynamic tension.